sitting comfortably, then I'll begin. For those of you who are over 60, 50. So welcome to the final ramble of the series. I've been unpacking some of the reflections I gave voice to in my funeral oration at Adisthana in the ceremony for Sangharakshita. And I said something there in very brief form that I think have much more depth to them than I'm able to put it, was able to put in a 15-minute slot. So I've been trying to explore that a little bit over the last couple of days, and I'll conclude that tonight. I've been especially really looking at the implications of a sort of double response to Sangharakshita. Response to him as an overwhelmingly effective Dhamma teacher and former of Sangha, setting out of a way that is, it seems, applicable all over the world. There's nowhere yet we've found where it doesn't really work. It seems to apply to the modern world everywhere in a rather unique way so far. Mm-hmm. Although many are beginning to say, well, Sangharakshita was there before us, and we realise we must go that way too. But at the same time, we know that there are various conundrums and paradoxes and difficulties in Sangharakshita's life that some people have found very difficult to come to terms with. And I certainly did myself for a while. So I've been trying to reflect in these talks on what that means. You know, if you see these things that are difficult for you, does that mean that the rest of it is rubbish? Or if you see this, the wonderful thing, does it mean that you just ignore what is more problematic? And I've been suggesting, I hope, a way of understanding this that is realistic and that actually relates to you and me. And I've been talking about my own experience as a Dhamma practitioner and as a leader and a teacher and quite a big influence in the small world of our movement. I've been speaking about, during this 40th anniversary year, reflecting on what I was like 40 years ago, so inspired. And I think I said yesterday, I'm no more inspired than I was then and no less inspired, if you see what I mean. Just that the inspiration has got more ample and more grounded in many ways. But it's the same inspiration. And I think what I saw then is what I see now. And the experience that I had then of the Dhamma is the experience that I have now. I'm just more at ease with it and more able to ground it in my experience. So yes, there was that. But I was so naive. And my own pride and self-interest was mixed up in my activity for the Dhamma, my work for the Dhamma. And as a consequence, I did things that put people off the Dhamma. The thing I most regret is that things I've done or said have meant people didn't connect with Tri Ratna. I hope they connected somewhere with the Dhamma, but they didn't through us and through me. And that, you know, some things I've thought and said and done have caused people harm, caused people pain. So one has to sort of come to some assessment of that. You know, there's this great inspiration, this very strong desire to serve the Dhamma and to bring it to others. And at the same time, a rather raw and unfinished personality. So how is one to deal with that? Well, I suppose one just has to accept, in retrospect, that that was the case, and probably, to some extent, still is. I still make mistakes that people are harmed by, or at least don't like, at the very least. So does that really mean that we should just wait until we're the finished product? That would be the temptation, do you see what I mean? To say that, okay, young Subhuti, you're extremely inspired, that's wonderful. Now, go away for 45 years, probably a bit more, and get yourself sorted out so that you're perfect, and then you can spread the Dhamma. Well, I hope, brothers and sisters, that you will say, no, Subhuti, no, Subhuti, because if you'd done that, we wouldn't be here, if you see what I mean. That's the plain fact of it, that those rough and ready men and women of 40, 50 years ago who made up the Western Buddhist order, as it was at that time, led by this extraordinary genius, Sangharakshita, with his own workings out still going on, we formed this, we together formed this thing that I think many of you have come to in deep appreciation and are yourselves now participating in. I think this is something we need to sort of recognize quite clearly, that you cannot leap fully formed as a Buddha. It's not possible. You cannot just stay hidden until you are finished. Because as soon as you start to enter into interaction with the world, all the distance between your inspiration and your conditioned reality shows up, if you see what I mean. It's exposed. So I'm not trying to excuse, by the way. I'm not trying to lessen my regret for things that I've done that have hurt. And I'm sure Sangharakshita wouldn't want to do that. And in fact, he made that very clear. So please don't misunderstand me. But I'm trying to explain a sort of principle that's not just to do with me, but it's to do with you. You're probably in many ways better than me. I don't know. And certainly the context is more mature. So you're less likely to make the sort of mistakes that we made back then. The times are different. And well, our order has people in it who've been around like me for 45 years and who have made some progress on the path and come to some deeper understanding of themselves. So it's, the whole thing is much more mature. But still, it will go on. You will make mistakes. Sorry, I'm not trying to insult you, but it's the truth. You will do things that, in some cases, put people off. You'll do things that hurt people. You'll do things that, even sometimes without your realising it, cause them pain that may affect them quite strongly. I hope you don't, but don't be surprised if you do. Regret it deeply if you realise that you've done it, but don't stop. One has to engage in the practice of the Dhamma and engage especially in an active Sangha in order to discover yourself. It's through my participation in the Sangha, it's through my work to, you know, as one of those who set up this centre, that I've come to a better understanding of my own conditioned character. I spoke yesterday of character as a sort of given that is largely the result of pre-existing conditions, in Buddhist terms, coming from a previous life, some of them, and from the cultural circumstances, the economic circumstances, social circumstances in which you're born, the genetic material that you have. It's a sort of given that you're not directly responsible for, but your failure to really understand it and your failure to disentangle that from your practice of the Dhamma and your practice of the spreading of the Dhamma leads to problems. And the way in which you discover your character is in action. You discover who you are and what you are in your interaction with others. And you discover it through making mistakes. That is why Sangha is so important. Sangha is the arena, it's one aspect of it, it's the arena within which you discover yourself, because you're coming up against other characters, other individuals who have their own unconsciousness about their own character and conditioning. And together you come to discover who you really are. That is what your given is, what your conditioned given is. So Whilst, of course, yes, again, I stress, I'm not trying to justify or excuse, I'm trying to explain and suggest that it's a bit inevitable. I hope that as the years go by, as the generations go by, a really mature Buddhist movement emerges in which it's much easier and quicker to discover yourself. It's much easier now than it was when I started out. I was the chairman of the only centre in the Triratna at the age of 25 and 1 month, 26 and 1 month. My goodness, was I naive. You're nodding, is it? Yes. Only teasing, sorry. But you're right. I was extremely naive. And also, you know, not able to disentangle my inspiration from my pride, from my self-attachment. As a result of working with old codgers like David Mitra over there and others, we came to understand more about ourselves and our own character, and about each other too. We came to discover ourselves much more sort of deeply, and to accept ourselves much more fully. And I think one of the things about the movement today, and I feel this especially at the LBC, that it's able to encompass a broader and broader range of character in the sense that I was talking of it yesterday. Not just of cultural conditioning and nationality and ethnicity and so forth, but of character in the broadest sense. I think an ideal Sangha is able to take in anybody who comes to it, if you see what I mean, and to be able to allow them to discover their conditioned character. It will never be perfect, and it'll always be having to expand its boundaries, and it'll always be difficult for some people. And I just hope that people do stick at it and have confidence that the Sangha as a whole is flexible enough to take in a larger and wider range of character in the sense of the given, conditioned given. And it's a cause of great, great joy to me coming to this centre at this point, seeing it, well, in the phrase of the times, so diverse. It wasn't like that in the beginning. It really wasn't like that. It was almost exclusively white, middle class, educated, a lot more men than women, for instance. And we've been able, because of the vision that Bhante gave us, we've been able to expand and provide room, at least room for people to winkle themselves in and slowly create the room for themselves. So this is for me, you know, as one of those who worked pretty hard to set this place up, one of the greatest causes of joy to see that you, in all your richness and diversity, have found yourselves at least beginning to be at home. I heard one of the talks of Sanjay there at the weekend, talking about himself as a born in Bethnal Green of Indian and English parentage, and not really finding himself at home anywhere until he came in contact with the movement. It's hearing things like that make me feel, oh well, I didn't do so badly. Not me alone, but we didn't do so badly. So what I think we need to recognise is that it's Sangha, it's interaction with Sangha, and Sangham isn't just a passive thing. Sangha is active. It's trying to work in the world. It's trying to affect the world. If it's closed, it's just going to become a sort of a group in which a limited range of characters are sort of finding some sort of symbiosis together. The Sangha, by definition, has to be expansive and opening up more and more broadly. Without that, I think a spiritual life is going to be extremely difficult. One will be refining upon one's own idiosyncrasies, as it were. And spiritual progress will be a sort of a self-delusion. And I've seen it. Not only have I seen it, I've done it at times, where you think you're making real progress, but you're just avoiding your lack of understanding of your own conditioning. This has been termed even by psychotherapists working in this world as spiritual bypass. You don't actually deal with your basic conditioning and its effects. And a genuine, a true sangha is bringing people into the sort of interaction, sometimes quite painful, which leads you to understand yourself better and to understand others better and to open up your range, as it were. So I see the whole issue with Bhante in the same way, if you see what I mean. I think that he grew during his time as a teacher. It's hard for me to say that because he started off over my horizon, if you see what I mean. He was always bigger than me. But I think I can say from my, you know, ant-like perspective that the elephant grew a bit. He wasn't the sort of person to talk about that kind of thing. But, you know, it certainly appeared like that he himself changed and grew. And his change and growth was somehow intimately interconnected with the growth and change of the movement. They were almost identical in a certain way. And I think it's very important that we sort of understand this about each other, about ourselves, and even about our teachers. You will not find, I'm sure you already realise this, any perfect teachers here at the LBC. They're pretty nearly perfect. I have to say that because they'll give me flowers later. But you won't find perfect teachers here. And you won't find anybody who pretends they're perfect. Bhante never, ever, ever pretended he was perfect. He would never talk about his attainment. When he was asked, "Are you a stream entrant?" he merely said, "It's important to have confidence in your teacher." But that confidence cannot be based, this is me talking now, your confidence cannot be based upon some sort of abstract notion of perfection. It has to be based on your own experience and what you get. So, yes, I think it's a good enough movement. And we, the early generation, have been good enough order members. And Bhante has been a good enough teacher, even maybe more than good enough. And probably we can't expect much more than that. Good enough means that it's growing and that it will bring you to the path. A very good poem by Bhante on this theme about the being given a record collection. And I should have quoted it to you. It's such a lovely poem. But an order member gave him his record collection with the words, "I'm sorry, it's not a very good one." And so Bhante's poem says, you know, though your record collection is not complete, it is good enough to hear the classics. And it goes on like that, and it ends with, though your teacher is not fully enlightened, he's good enough to show you the path. So we need to understand a good enough movement, good enough teachers, which is not a belittling way of thinking. Good enough because they're connected to the Dhamma, because the Dhamma lives in them. So I want to move on now to sort of applying that a bit more to what Sangharakshita was, in a sense, what he is, and how we can understand him. Or at least get a bit more of an understanding of him. Now he's gone. How are we to kind of think about him? And I think there's some clues in some of the very last things that he wrote. You know that for the last years of his life, he was not able to write because his eyesight had deteriorated. He had macular degeneration of the eye, so his eye was distorted. So he couldn't see what he'd written. He used to make notes. I used to find that if I go to see him, he'd make notes of what he wanted to talk to me about. And he says, "Oh, I can't see, Subhuti, what is it that I want to talk to you about?" And I couldn't read this horrendous scrawl. Anyway, he'd usually work it out. But so he used to dictate. And for the last years of his life, he dictated quite a series of papers, usually two or three pages, which are deceptively simple because the medium itself dictated a really simplified mode of communication. And sometimes I would read them and think, oh yeah, I knew that. And then you think, no, wait a minute, there's something more that's in here. There's a definite punch in here in very simple ways. So the last two papers he wrote, as far as I'm aware, were on rebirth and on the Mantrayana, which is really rather interesting that these were the last two things that he focused on, especially because it when you look at his life in the latter years, it does look as if there was a process of completion going on and that everything sort of falls into place, a sort of intuitive feeling out of the right thing to do before he goes, finishing off his work. So it's quite to be remarked upon that these are the two last things and one must reflect on why. So the second to last was some reflections on rebirth, which is mainly saying that you cannot be a Buddhist and not believe in rebirth because it's so deeply embedded in the Dhamma, in all its main phases. So for instance, in the so-called Arahat path, the so-called Hinayana, the path consists of the movement from stream entry, once returnership, non-returnership, arahatva. And that takes a maximum of seven lives. So you can complete the path in one life, but only if there's a great deal of preparation already from previous lives. So from the outset, the Buddhist path is conceived of in the context of limitless lives. And the final stages of the path are conceived as a process of moving through various stages, which can take up to seven lifetimes. So he's saying that, your take on Buddhism is this kind of more basic approach of attaining individual liberation, then you can't do that without a conception of rebirth. There's even more the case with the other main branch of Buddhism, the other main ideal of Buddhism, which is the ideal of attaining full and perfect Buddhahood. That is preparing yourself to gain enlightenment in a time, in a place where there's no Dhamma, which is what our Buddha, the Buddha Shakyamuni, is supposed to have done. There was no trace of the Dhamma in the world, according to Buddhist tradition, and he took a vow to be reborn and to rediscover the path and open it up. So for Mahayanists, this is the ideal. Believe it or not, if you are following the Mahayana path, you are aspiring to be a bodhisattva who is eventually going to become a full and perfect Buddha. You can see that if that's your ideal, it's not going to happen before breakfast tomorrow, or even breakfast in the next lifetime. It's quite a big and long process. I'll have more to say about that in a moment. So he's saying that the central ideals, the two main ways of conceiving of the ideal in Buddhism, both are inextricably bound up with the idea of rebirth. And you cannot really conceive of the Buddhist ideal without that. This is not a universally accepted perspective in Western Buddhism, not in Eastern Buddhism. It's universal in Eastern Buddhism, as far as I know. And the Pali texts and the earliest texts attest to it. So that's the first paper. Quite interesting. He's sort of not talked about these two perspectives for a long, long time, and has rather tended to downplay the distinction. And in the end, they're not really distinct, but they are the ways in which the path is conceived. In the second paper, it's a little less clear why he's doing it, if you see what I mean. Of course, it's interesting that he's talking about rebirth just months before his death. And, you know, he told me that he did believe in rebirth and that he knew he would come back. More about that later. But in the second paper, the one on the Mantrayana, he says that the Bodhisattva ideal is divided into two parts, or two different conceptions, or two different methods, really, or two different ways. The first way is the way of the laborious process of lifetime by lifetime accumulating the paramitas, the perfections that are needed to be a full and perfect Buddha. Again, I'll say more about that in a bit. So it's a long, slow process of effort, of working upon yourself, increasingly sustained by the suprapersonal power of the bodhicitta, but it's a long, slow, steady process, lifetime by lifetime. The other path, the Mantrayana, the other division, as it were, of the Mahayana path, the Bodhisattva path, is the Mantrayana. And this is, he says, has sometimes been referred to as magical Buddhism. I think it might be better to, I was suggesting in the discussion this morning, to call it alchemical Buddhism, if you see what I mean. It's got a slightly less easily dismissible ring to it. It's the Buddhism that teaches that if you engage with certain mantras and you recite these with sufficient faith, sufficient concentration, and in the right context, and received in the right way from the a qualified guru, they can take you to enlightenment in a single lifetime. He says that to some people this appeals very strongly, but not to everybody. Again, I can guess at why he said these things. He didn't explain it at all. He just spelled it out. But I do have my own ideas about why he did it, which I'm not going to fully tell you. But you might understand them in what I'm saying. I think it's very, very significant what somebody says right at the end of their life, especially somebody as intuitively awake as that man was. A very, very strong sense of the right of the moment, if you see what I mean. A very, very strong sense of the current and the tide of things. So I think, maybe Paramartha or somebody like that can say more about what was going on when he did it. But to me, it appears to be deeply significant that his last collected thoughts were on the theme of the Mantrayana. I'm going to look at Sangharakshita from each of these points of view, because I think that helps us to understand a bit better who he was and how we are to relate to him, if you see what I mean, and where we put what he referred to me as the messy bits, the bits that are untidy about him, arguably more than untidy in some people's eyes, at least. How are we to see this extraordinary man who's not with us anymore, and who has had such a huge influence upon what this movement is, that we have to come to some way of thinking about him and understanding him, and therefore speaking about him. So I think we can look at him under each of these headings. I'm not suggesting that each of these headings should become part of our bread and butter of discussion, but I'm suggesting that they do give us some perspective on what he was, what he's given to us, and how we are to relate to him. So first of all, just thinking of him as a teacher of the arahat path. He never pretended to be an arahat. He never claimed any attainment for himself. But what he did do was set out the fundamental path of the Dhamma extremely clearly, in crystalline form, a diamond sharp form. I remember the sort of shock of listening to those talks on the Eightfold Path. I'd sort of dabbled around in Buddhism and read a bit of scriptures and so forth, but quite confused. Zen, bits of Tibetan, bits of Theravada. I couldn't really put it all together. And Sangha Rakshan just puts it in such immediate, human, intelligible terms that relate to me as a human being, and that make me know what I've got to do. He's got that extraordinary quality of putting the first steps of the path before you. If you like, as a teacher of the path of individual transformation, which the ultimate of which is arahatva, freedom for me. And I think he's been an exceptionally brilliant teacher in this way, and boiled it all down without distorting or oversimplifying. And what I'm particularly struck by is that it works here, it works in India, where people are not, these days they're much more educated, much more sophisticated, but in the early days they're very, very simple and uneducated. But they took on just the same Dhamma as we take on, and took it up with just the same clarity that they got from Bhante. There's something about his understanding that is universal and sets out that basic path very, very clearly. Some people have dismissed him as a teacher because of the elements of his action that they find unskillful. Arguably, they're right. I don't personally feel that at all. I feel that his understanding is much greater sometimes than his own ability to live it out. And he's pretty good, pretty good. I've never really seen him be unkind. I've never seen him be inattentive. I've never seen him unmindful. Maybe he's misjudged situations, but as I've already been arguing in those last 2 days, that's not an easy thing to do, to judge fully. So yes, you could argue that he's not beyond this point. You know, for instance, he's sexually active, therefore he couldn't have been this or a that or the other. Frankly, I couldn't care less. What I care is he's given me the path that I can follow in a thorough, clear way. So as a teacher of the basic path, I think he's, I won't say second to none, because there are very good teachers out there, but certainly for me, a unique clarity, and it presents the Dhamma not as a technical subject, if you see what I mean, whilst he's referring to the technicalities of traditional Buddhism. What he presents to you is something so human and immediate and direct. Someone was to be intensely grateful to him for that, for setting out the path to us. Setting out a path that has created a sangha of people who are practicing very sincerely, set out by a man who never himself had the opportunity to participate in sangha. It's one of the extraordinary things about Bhante that, he was so... sui generis under his own category, if you see what I mean. He never really had companions on the path of an equal level to him. Maybe Lama Govinda, and of course he had his own teachers, but he never really participated in sangha. And yet he was able to envision and body forth sangha in an extremely effective way, so that people could discover themselves in the way that I've been speaking of, and therefore together tread the path in this immediate, very basic, almost psychologically clear way. There's more to him than that. He's a teacher of the Bodhisattva path. Been able to communicate to his disciples and embody in the order and movement that he founded a spirit that is beyond the personal, what in the Mahayana is called the bodhicitta, chitta means consciousness or awareness, although it's consciousness or awareness as a dynamic phenomenon, not just as a blank awareness. he's been able to, and that is really based in what is ultimate, a consciousness that is beyond the personal, beyond my consciousness, that I can connect with and try to live out. I think that's what I did for the last 45 years. I connected with that through Sangharakshita. He was able to communicate that to me in a living way and to embody it in himself in a highly effective way that enabled me to live not just this sort of basic path of individual effort, but a path of self-transcendence, a path of a living out my life, not just for myself, but for others too. And we know that in 1957 or 8, I can't remember the year, sorry, but sometime around then, he took the Bodhisattva vow from one of his teachers, Dada Rinpoche, who he says he regarded as a living Bodhisattva. And so he took the vow to live his life not just for his own personal release from suffering, but for the ultimate fulfillment of the entire world, of the entire universe, in effect. The vow to save all sentient beings is the way it's put, perhaps a little literalistically. But he took the vow to not live just for himself. And this movement is the embodiment of that vow. The function of a bodhisattva, one of the functions of the bodhisattva, is to form what is called a gunna, a community, a movement, you could say. It's to form a sangha, a community of people gathered around him or her who are imbued with the spirit of the bodhisattva and who are taught the practices they need to live out the bodhisattva life and who come into an interaction with each other that enables the bodhicitta to arise amongst them. That is the fulfillment of his bodhisattva vow. For all his own limitations of character and circumstance, he was able to do that. And that, to me, marks him as a true bodhisattva. A bodhisattva on the path somewhere, somewhere way beyond where I can see, but still on the path. A bodhisattva sets out on this path, takes the vow to accumulate all the necessary conditions to be a Buddha. This image here is backed by these two shapes, one shape with another shape within it, which represents the accumulation that the Bodhisattva has been gathering in order to be a Buddha. So the outer golden shape symbolizes the punya sambhara, the accumulation of merit. So the bodhisattva, lifetime after lifetime, perfects his activity and his mind or her mind, so that gradually these the merits that are accumulated begin to pattern every new existence. So that every renewed coming into being, coming into space and time, there's a greater adequacy of form to content, if you see what I mean. So that at every rebirth, the bodhisattva, because of this accumulation of merit, creates a body even, a mind, in traditional language, a speech, a communicative faculty that is more and more adequate to the task. Huh? So, you know, Sangharakshita spoke of himself as being, in many ways, not really the right person to start a new movement, that he lacked so many of the necessary qualities and talents, but he was the one to do it. Well, a bodhisattva sets out to accumulate those necessary talents and qualities. Through their skillful action lifetime by lifetime, through practicing the paramitas. Some of you will have listened to that series, that brilliant series by Sangharakshita on the Bodhisattva ideal, where he discusses these paramitas. So you set out consciously to cultivate each of these faculties, morality, patience, etc., meditation, energy, I can't remember off the top of my head. So gradually you accumulate this this sort of aura. Your presentation in the world is more and more adequate to the ideal that you're trying to promote, that you're trying to live out. You see what I mean? So that it's said that the Bodhisattva in lifetime by lifetime becomes more and more good looking, because it's well known that the more good looking you are, the more seriously people you take you. It's always been my problem. But it's true. You know, if you're both very handsome or very beautiful, very attractive, and you've got a sort of glow to you, people are going to take you more seriously. That doesn't mean you should feel bad about not being like that. I certainly don't. But you know, it ultimately, if that's what you're trying to do, is to really be an effective spreader of the Dhamma, try to develop the form that makes it most adequate. For instance, develop the faculty of learning languages, so that your mind is flexible enough to open up to varied communication. There's one of the teachings about the Bodhisattva is the four pratisamvids, and they're to do with these sort of accumulations of skills in that sort of way. Not languages specifically mentioned, but you could easily include it. So the punya sambhara, the radiance of the Bodhisattva's merit, is the increasing embodiment of these virtues that form the world in which the Bodhisattva is born, is reborn, which pattern, even you might say, I don't work out the biology of it, pattern the DNA that work themselves out through that. And the Bodhisattva in the Tibetan tradition is supposed to develop the skill to find the ideal rebirth. You can take this as literally or as metaphorically as you like, that's up to you. But that's the outer aura, the aura that surrounds the body. Then there's a head aura, which is the jnana sambhara, the accumulation of wisdom. So lifetime by lifetime, the Bodhisattva is developing prajna paramita, or jnana paramita in later tradition, is accumulating the understanding of the reality, the direct understanding of reality, and embodying it more and more perfectly. So that by the time the last lifetime comes, the Bodhisattva has the full accumulation of merit and wisdom, and is able to manifest in the world, in a world which is completely bereft of the path to salvation, the path to freedom, which has no way out. Bodhisattva is able to manifest within that as a Buddha, is able to go through the process of discovering the path of liberation. And that's what this image it represents. It represents the end of the Bodhisattva path, that you are through your life, your lives, accumulating all the merits and all the wisdom that's necessary to help beings gain liberation who have no access to freedom. You know, we can all do that in our own way, on our own level. Even in this life, we're trying to accumulate, through our interaction with each other, the necessary qualities, both collectively, and I think that's one thing that we do as a community, develop those qualities. I may not have them, I certainly don't have them all, but I may have something that I contribute to the pool of what we all have. But through that, we're accumulating those in ourselves, and next lifetime we may be able to manifest a bit better and be able to help many more beings. But even in this lifetime, we can try to go to new circumstances and situations and reach out to people who haven't got the Dhamma. So many of them. and try to extend our range by living out this Bodhisattva ideal on a level that's realistic for us. So yes, Sangharakshita is a teacher of the Bodhisattva path, and he himself is a living, well, he was a living Bodhisattva and is now a Bodhisattva waiting to re-manifest, I'm convinced of it, and will be back, as I said, as he said. Yes, he wasn't a perfect Bodhisattva, because a perfect Bodhisattva is a Buddha, has accumulated all the merit and jnana to manifest in a Buddha's body. He's on the way. Who knows how long? But he's on that way. And we're incredibly great, incredibly fortunate to have been in the company of a Bodhisattva of that quality, and to have been our lives to have been touched by him. I myself, deeply inspired and moved and motivated by the Bodhisattva ideal, but I cannot imagine having even begun to conceive of that path without my contact with him. It doesn't mean that you have to have that contact, because you've got contact with what his radiance, as it were, the radiance that he's left in the world, which is pretty good. It's a good enough movement. It's a good enough Bodhisattva movement. But that isn't all there is to Sangharakshita. There's this other dimension which is represented by the Mantrayana, which, as I've said, is the path that sometimes spoken of under the heading of Vajrayana or Tantra, but perhaps most simply spoken under the heading of the Mantrayana. The idea that certain forms of words embody an energy of enlightenment, an energy of transcendence, that if you receive them in the right context and connect with them and sort of take them into you, or rather let them come into you, can transform you by themselves. No doubt, the more you do on the other levels, the better, the more easily they'll work, the more readily they'll work. But these mantras that have been handed on to Sangharakshita and that he's handed on to us are his way of introducing us to this alchemical dimension of the Buddha Dhamma, this dimension of the Buddha Dhamma that cannot be conceived of in ordinary spatio-temporal terms, that cannot be conceived of in terms of an ordinary kind of conditionality, a linear conditionality, that are to be conceived of in terms, well, are to be conceived of by not conceiving of them, by simply opening oneself up to them and allowing them to have that transformative effect upon one. And we no longer, in the order, for very good reasons, which I won't go into now, sort of buy into the whole framework of traditional Buddhism in this respect. We don't see those mantras that we have received and that do live amongst us in those terms. But the essence of it, which is, I think, why Sangharakshita made that his last paper, the essence of the power of those mantras is alive. And not just what of the mantras, but what those mantras represent. The main thing I got from my contact with Sangharakshita is completely beyond words. It's something that at times I've groped to talk about. But it's an absolutely indubitable sense of reality of the Dhamma as a living reality. Sorry, my words are going to trip over each other, but because by necessity. He was deeply in contact with that and was able to communicate that. He was able to communicate it through his expression of the Dhamma. He was able to communicate it in his communication. And often he was able to communicate it in his communication even when he was talking about the nuts and bolts of things. Something more came through in one's presence with him. something of what is ultimate lived in him, and he handed on to us in many ways, including in the form of these mantras, which of course every order member receives a mantra in that tradition at ordination, accompanied by images of bodhisattvas and Buddhas, and by relating to that image and that through that mantra, a very profound change takes place within one, which it's extremely hard to justify or speak of, because we're talking beyond the level of ordinary rational consciousness. Of course, the context of the rational, the context of the of individual effort, the context of the even the bodhisattva ideal is vitally important, but there's something else. Bhante famously said, there's something about me that is, what was his word, is inexplicable. There's something about me that is not easy to understand. He sort of pretty much said, I don't understand it either. And he said, therefore, there's something about this Triratna that is inexplicable. There's something that can't be caught in words, something uncanny. There's something very, very uncanny about Bhante. Uncanny in the sense you can't know it. That, I believe, was the Mantrayana teacher, if you like, that he was deeply in contact with that level of reality, and he communicated that to us, and it's embodied in our community. Many of you not ordained, you may not have encountered this through that form, but it's there. It's there for you, and many of you will know it. I wasn't present at the puja the other night here, but I caught its flavour from people talking about it, and a flavour of something other, of something more, something greater came through, which is the Mantrayana, a touch of the Mantrayana that Bhante had embodied it was able to body forth. And as a Mantrayana teacher, I think he's faultless. I think that whatever there may be on other levels, and I think there are, I think on that level he's beyond reproach. That it, on that level he truly lived, if you see what I mean. That's what he truly was, and that's what he is now. And I'm sure that when he the time is ripe, when the circumstances unfold, when whatever ensues upon his own death has fulfilled itself, he's had the rest that he clearly feels he needs, that will re-manifest and will continue to work for the benefit of the world in the way that it has done throughout this life. And I'm sure that it will reconnect in one way or another with this order that he has begun, this movement that he has begun. We won't try and find him and sit him in front of his typewriter or something like that. He told me, you know, oh, I'll sort that out for myself. And he more or less said, look, don't go and interfere because you'll ruin it. I think that when we think about Sangharakshita, we need to take everything that I've been talking about over these 3 days into consideration. The necessity of there being a sort of discrepancy between conditioned being and even conditioned manifestation and transcendental experience and reality. It takes time to make them coextensive. In fact, the Buddhist tradition says that it takes huge lifetimes for that accumulation of merit and wisdom to take place. Though, you know, we must own up to all our mistakes in the past, we mustn't try to disguise them. If we try to disguise them, that would make them worse, if you see what I mean. And if we own up to them, I won't say it makes them all right, but it means that they contribute to something further, something higher. Do you see what I mean? When you own up to your own mistakes, you transcend them. Doesn't mean they go away, but you transcend them. So it's important that we face up to that, face up even perhaps to Sangharakshita's limitations in that respect. I don't think we need to spend a lot of time eviscerating ourselves over it, but we just need to honestly say, this happened, that happened, maybe that wasn't so good, and so on. But we need to recognise that this is kind of inevitable, and that especially if one is to engage so vigorously and so boldly in transforming and in establishing something so new under such circumstances. And I think to that extent one can see that Sangharakshita was a brilliant teacher of the Arahat path, a brilliant setter out of individual path of transformation. For all his own limitations, he created something that does not, of definition, have limitations. Do you see what I mean? He was a remarkable bodhisattva on a level that is beyond my imagining, and able to live out that bodhisattva ideal in a very full way. Again, despite his own the paramitas, he still has to work on. He was a remarkable bodhisattva who was able to make the spirit of the bodhisattva, the bodhicitta, live in the movement he created. And he was a remarkable teacher of the Mantrayana, a remarkable Mantrayana guru. He was able to communicate through mantra, and mantra in the larger sense of through word and through presence, he was able to communicate transcendental reality. And communicate it very powerfully and effectively, which is why so many of us feel so deeply loyal to him, and why so many people who've never encountered him feel so such extraordinary fortune in having come into indirect contact with him. I especially think of that in India. So I hope I've given a sort of framework for you to understand yourself a bit better in some ways against that whole background, and a framework to understand our movement and its own history with all, warts and all, and a framework to understand a Sangharakshita, our teacher, for all his particularities of character and action and behaviour and so on. And to recognise that, you yourself are good enough. If you're engaging and constantly engaging, you're doing okay. You will have to face your own limitations. You will have to learn more fully who you are. You'll have to come to terms with your own conditioning, and you'll have to integrate your own conditioning into a larger community, which will have to open up to welcome you. It may take time. The movement and your own teachers within the movement are good enough. In fact, they're pretty good. They've enabled a real Sangha to come into being and to enable the wonderful atmosphere there is at the LBC, for instance, which every time I come as president, I come, you know, to lick my finger and test the water and see whether what its condition is, and to do a sort of quality control, and to be frank, it just gets better and better and better. Things that need to improve. I'll have a word with the chair later. it's certainly good enough. Our teacher, whatever his limitations of character that he said he had, and whatever we may think of some of the things he did, is certainly good enough to get our feet on the path to engage us with the spirit that goes beyond us as individuals, and to connect us with reality itself. And we're exceptionally fortunate. And may we ourselves, put ourselves on these paths, the Arahat path, the path of individual transformation, the Bodhisattva path, the path of giving ourselves up of serving a larger ideal, the largest ideal. And may we connect with the ultimate and try to body that forth in our own manifestation within space and time. So thank you very much indeed for giving me this chance to unpack what I had 15 minutes to say. I think I'm going to have to do a further set of talks to unpack my unpacking, and no doubt ad infinitum. But I'm very grateful to you. I've not spared, pulled my punches, so I hope that you'll forgive me for any lack of smoothness, if you see what I mean. And it's a privilege to me to have, well, not a privilege, that's not the right word, but an enormous opportunity for me to have people willing to listen to my unpacking of my reflections on what my understanding, because unless I do that, I don't understand. So thank you so much.